Yeah, Karolina Saransky. We've met before
Yes,
at the
yes.
ISS and at University of the Free State. And I think, as we told you in the mail, the background to the interview is our 25th anniversary in January 2014. We exist 25 years, and we're looking at some of the high points of our 25th years of existence. And 15 years ago, you received an honorary doctorate from our university.
Yes,
I was wondering, just to start off, do you recall why you decided to accept the honorary doctorate at the time?
Well, I was very interested in what you were doing, because I believe in liberal education. I think it has been underdeveloped in Europe, and I thought that what you were doing was a real, exciting, forward-looking kind of program that could influence developments in education in the rest of Europe.
You know, liberal arts education is very much under threat here, too. And how would you describe the value of liberal arts education, of humanistic education?
Okay, so the value of liberal education is really many things. I think, first of all, not what I focus on, but it does have a value for business and industry. Countries like China and Singapore, which have wanted to, of course, capitalize on their business cultures, they've recognized that they have too little critical thinking and they have too little stimulation of the imagination. And so both countries have introduced massive increases in the amount of humanistic and artistic education in recent years. And that's just for business culture. Okay, so because we live in a mobile economy, and we can't just get by with the skills that are learned by rote, because next year they won't be any good. So what is needed is a mobile imagination, and I think that entrepreneurs know that. Now, in fact, Apple has a whole university of its own that employs philosophers, artists, and so on, because that's what they think is needed to design good products for the future. Okay, so that's the first thing. The second thing is that people have whole lives, and they need to find meaning in their lives. One area where humanistic education is growing very rapidly is continuing adult education, because those are people who have had lots of work experience, but they're grappling with life issues, with loss, with friendship, with the possibility of death, and so on. And they need to get that sustenance from something. Okay, but then the third thing, which is what I mainly focus on, is democratic political culture. It's, I think, very short-sighted for countries to value democracy but not think what keeps it alive. And ever since Socrates, who understood that democracy needs vigilance, good arguments, listening, analysis, people have understood that the ingredients supplied by philosophy, by literature and the arts, are essential for the health of democracy. And the first really is critical capacity. If people just go along with what tradition tells them or what their leaders tell them, that's a very dangerous state of affairs for democracy. And we know that people can do this all too easily. So learning how to criticize, argue, and to do so in a rigorous and respectful way. The second thing that it supplies for democracy is knowledge of the world and its history. We all have to talk to each other across national borders, regional borders, group borders. And so if we don't know about world history, the global economy, the major world religions, then we really can't conduct those conversations in a meaningful way. And then the third thing is the mobility of the imagination, the ability to connect imaginatively with the lives of others. This is an ability that all human beings are born with in some form, but like any human innate ability, it needs to be developed by education, or otherwise it's just going to be very obtuse. We're all good at thinking about people near to us, and we're not so good at thinking about the lives of people who are from a different group or who are far away in another country, but we have to think about their point of view if we are to make good judgments about policies that affect their lives. So that's what I emphasize is the contribution to democracy.
do you see major differences in democratic practices within U.S. society and European society?
Well, of course, we have to remember that higher education is just one part of people's lives. They all come from families, and they, even while they're in university, they have their peer culture, and then they go out into a workplace. So we shouldn't expect that universities by themselves can decisively change the course of events. But I guess what I would say is that we don't have the crisis of religious fear and animosity that I see in Europe. I recently wrote a book about this, and I really did come to the conclusion that in the U.S., for a variety of different reasons, but I think partly because of education, people are just not as fearful of people who are of different religion or who might be immigrants, who wear clothes that are unfamiliar and so on. And this is, of course, as you know, in the Netherlands, a major crisis all over Europe. And so I do think that's one way of understanding this contrast.
Yes, because I think indeed in Holland and broader in Europe, also economic problems seem to go hand in hand with the growth of xenophobia, Islamophobia, and other discriminatory practices that are rather increase social injustices. Now, what would you recommend to young students faced with, you know, such problems in terms of their choice of education and the focus that they develop in their education?
Well, I guess I think it's important that they should get as broad an education as possible for as long as it is possible. And that's why I love the U.S. liberal arts system, because you don't just have the option to have a broad education. You're made to do it. It's part of the requirement. So a student who's going to major in commerce or in computer science has to take philosophy and literature and so on all the way through the university level. Well, if you don't have a system like that, then at least in the high school, try to get as broad an education as possible, but hopefully you can also find a way of selecting into a university that permits a broader program, such as your own or other programs in Holland, which I recognize that some of them impose an additional cost, and so there's a real issue of elitism in some of the programs, for example, in Utrecht, that do offer a liberal education. So I think it would be better if those programs were available to everyone without any additional cost. But anyway, just do whatever you can. And if you can't avail yourself of such a formal program, there are all kinds of ways of educating yourself informally, particularly in Holland with this very strong public culture of philosophy. And I've never seen a country where there's so much general public interest in philosophy, through the magazine philosophy, but also through just lectures and seminars. People can go to those seminars, and they do, and they take part in it. And, of course, just reading works of literature, going to films and concerts and so on.
Question, in a time of great youth unemployment, because, you know, Europe has a lot of youth unemployment, how could you motivate students to pursue humanistics education at this particular point in time?
Well, I guess I would say two different things. The first thing to say is that actually, as far as U.S. data go, English majors have lower unemployment than computer science majors. There's a glut on the market now of narrow, technically trained people, and they're not getting jobs. So actually, for employment purposes, being a literature major is a very good choice. I don't know the data in Europe, but you could look into it, and I bet you would find something similar. But the second thing is, you know, some of this unemployment is caused by bad politics and bad decision-making. And so rather than just taking this passively, you need to equip yourself to become the person who thinks critically, who challenges that, and who tries to create a different public culture. And that's urgent. So I think if you have the opportunity to go to university, don't just try to fit in, but try to be an agent of sensible change.
If you were to write a sequence to Fragility of Goodness, in 2014, what would that look on? What kind of issues would you focus on? I'm asking you this because at the University of Humanistics, too, we tried to connect the classics to contemporary socio-political problems.
And
you know, many of our students do read also Fragility of Goodness and then beyond. But yeah, I was just interested.
My most recent book that just came out this week, and it is being translated into Dutch right now, I think it's called Political Emotions, Why Love Matters for Justice. And this is really very closely connected to Fragility of Goodness because it talks about how aspirations to have a just society are fragile. They need sustenance by people who care about them. A just society asks people to make sacrifices for the common good. Well, it's not going to persist if people are not willing to do that, if they don't love one another in some way that makes them willing to make sacrifices. So then what I do is to study the history of that issue as a history within liberal political philosophy. I then, in more depth, investigate both the resources and the problems in human psychology that we have to grapple with. And then the third part studies concrete historical instances where people's emotions have been successfully shaped in order to promote greater justice for minorities or for poorer people, looking at the United States and at India as two contrasting countries. But I look at the role of political rhetoric, art and architecture, public parks, literature. So all of this, I believe, follows the themes of Fragility and Goodness. And there is a part of the book that's explicitly about the Greeks. And it's a chapter called Tragic and Comic Festivals. And here I say, the Greeks had these public festivals for tragedy and for comedy, which brought all citizens together, and they served a very important role by getting people to develop their imagination of human vulnerability, and in the case of comedy, embrace the body with all its messiness in a spirit of delight. What do modern societies, who can't bring everyone together in one big theater, what do they have to do to have a similar effect? And then I study a number of things that one might do, such as the creation of memorials, of parks, of theater for the public, political rhetoric, and so on. So I study such things as the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, which is a I think, a wonderfully successful instance of a public confrontation with a tragic event, which promotes a spirit of both critique and reconciliation. And I study Millennium Park in Chicago, which I think is a very Aristophanic excursion into the messiness and the hilarity of the body. And so I try to show what our modern analogs to the tragic and comic festivals might be.
Yeah. How do you think the idea of tragedy and comedy should translate to teaching and learning within humanistic education or the values that we try to teach with?
Well, I think it's still very important to teach, of course, the Greeks. Right now I'm getting ready for the beginning of classes in the fall, and I have a graduate seminar on Greek tragedy and philosophy, looking at what a whole series of philosophers have done to find a meaning in Greek tragedy. But I also think, as I say in my book, that there are many, many different ways that societies come to grips with those issues, and some of them are through visual art, through the creation of a park where people come together, through political rhetoric, through book clubs. I mean, I have a whole section in my book on book clubs where people decide, we're going to read a book together and talk about what it means to us. And I use, as an example, a novel about race relations in Chicago, how that confrontation with tragedy could bring people together in a spirit of critique and change. So, you know, I think we have to understand that tragedy was a particular historical moment, but that we have many resources in a modern culture to have similar achievements. I happen to love music, and there is a lot about music in the book, particularly the music of Tagore in India, because he thought that if you've got 1 million people singing a song that embraces a certain vision of India as inclusive and not sectarian, that would shape public attitudes towards religion and difference. And then, you know, I happen to myself be an opera lover, and that's not going to be such a broad public culture, but I know that, you know, you're near to Belgium, and I just wrote a long essay for the new production of Mozart's La Clemenza di Tito at the Belgian National Opera, where I argue that that opera embodies a vision of mercy, of imagination, of gentleness. And I try to do a fairly detailed musical analysis because I've actually sung parts of that opera. And so you can look at that on the website. I think they have the long version of the essay and then a shorter version in their program. And you can see that I think for not everyone, perhaps, but for those who are interested, opera can provide a wonderful vehicle for coming to grips with some of these issues of anger, forgiveness, and mercy.
Do you think such experience, such embodied experiences, should be part of higher education, of formal higher education? I know that you refer to Tagore's school regularly and the importance of embodied experiences. Should that have a place within the curriculum of higher education?
Well, I think general education, liberal education, does much too little with embodied experience, actually. And in lots of ways. I think dance is neglected as part of the general education humanities curriculum. Tagore thought that dance, music, and literature all had to go together, and he created these artworks for his students. And he particularly, this was more in secondary education than in the university. In the university, it was a little less emphasis on dance. But the reason was that women would not lose their shame unless they were given a specific choreography that they needed to execute. And then they developed greater mutual trust and greater daring. So I think that's one example of the very successful use of embodied experience. Another in my book about liberal education is the Chicago Children's Choir, which uses choral singing, where children are singing together, therefore blending their breath with other people, but also acting out the songs also. And that has been a wonderful spirited contribution to race relations and relations between rich and poor in Chicago. In the university, usually choral singing is just an extracurricular activity, and even music is usually neglected. But I do think that there should be more attention paid to all the non-literary arts when one thinks about what a curriculum of general education should look like. There's one liberal arts college near Chicago called Lawrence in Wisconsin, which has a music conservatory. And because it has a conservatory, their liberal arts program does include music, fine art, and even to some extent dance. And the students, at least, I don't think they all perform, you know, but they actually go to performances and they interact with their peers who are doing the performing and so on. And so the various different arts are much more integrated into the mainstream of the curriculum, and I think that's wonderful.
Yeah, thanks. Maybe to round off, is there perhaps, is there perhaps a message that you would like to give to the University of Humanistic Studies on our 25th anniversary? Is a very young university, obviously, just coming of age. Yes.
Well, I think the message I would give is that you're the hope of the future, that you have an idea which is not new entirely, but it is not old-fashioned by any means. It actually points forward in all kinds of ways, but particularly forward to a future for democracy, where we're going to have citizens who think critically, who know the history of the world, and who can communicate across lines of religion and race, but also who have disciplined and mobile imaginations. And I think that's a very, very precious thing, and that you should be really proud of the boldness and the solitary daring with which you undertook this in an atmosphere that probably didn't give you much support at first, but now we see that other universities are following that lead.